From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Mental illness remains one of those topics that seems to be hard for people to talk about. But Kathy Cronkite wants people to be open about depression. She's the daughter of famed TV news anchor and journalist Walter Cronkite. And Kathy is an author and journalist in her own right and has dealt with her own depression throughout her life. She spoke today in La Crosse at the annual Women's Fund of Greater La Crosse Luncheon about erasing the stigma that still surrounds mental illness. Brad Williams of Wisdom Radio in La Crosse is also asking questions. But first, I asked Kathy Cronkite when she decided her struggle with depression was something she wanted to share with others.
I had been battling depression probably for most of my life, but I didn't really know it until pretty late in life, and I was in my late 30s. And had been diagnosed. I had written a previous book about children of famous people and had been pretty forthcoming in that one about my life. And I tend to be, you know, I have no filters. If it's there, it's there. Pretty open about things. But I had been diagnosed with depression, and I was working for a radio station at that time. And one thing that happened was that the medication I was taking made me dry mouth, so I was drinking a lot of water and wasn't telling anybody because the stigma. I was very embarrassed, and I didn't want people to know. I was afraid, you know, I'd lose my autonomy on the radio and might lose sponsors or whatever. And but I had to tell my producer because I was running out in the hall to get unlike you, we weren't allowed to have water in the booth. So I had to run out all the time and get water. And so I had been kind of been aware of the issue of stigma and of what it's like to not talk about it. And then I picked up a magazine, and it was when Prozac was, you know, the big controversy, the big, you know, manufactured controversy. And so there was a cover story, U.S. News and World Report, and inside was a sidebar with Mike Wallace. And, you know, I grew up with Mike Wallace, and he's talking about his battle with depression and about taking medication and about, you know, all the things that go along with having a diagnosis and a well-controlled illness. And I was so stunned that this man who had such a reputation to lose, so to speak, that I didn't have, could be talking about it. And really in that instant, I went, this is the experience I want for other people to have too. That you don't have to be afraid, you don't have to be ashamed, and you can get well. And that was the moment when the book was born and when the stigma broke and when the whole rest of my life started.
And did that stigma break once you did come out with it and really start talking about it? Were there some people who were uncomfortable with it, or were people like, okay, we understand, or maybe I feel this way as well?
I learned that for me, the biggest stigma was my own, that the consequences that I had anticipated didn't really happen. I didn't, you know, lose my insurance. I didn't lose my – although I will tell you, once I did lose my insurance, I've had a very hard time getting it back again because of the depression. But I didn't lose my job, those things. And I, as far as I know, I didn't lose any friends. I certainly didn't lose any friends that mattered to me or I would have noticed. And I can think of one or two people in my life who are – not comfortable with it, either don't really think it's a real illness and don't know why I'm yammering on about it, or think that, you know, psychiatry and medications are, you know, evil, and so we just kind of have a detente on it. But it is astonishing that there are still people, and that was, you know, a good number of years ago, that there are still people who have those kinds of problems.
And your book, On the Edge of Darkness, I mean, that came out about 15, 16 years ago.
Came out, I think, 92.
Okay, so my math is off.
That's all right.
It came out almost two decades ago. And in the book, you talk about how the stigma exists about people with depression. And you're going through and trying to think about it. And I'm wondering, in that time, in those almost 20 years, I mean, has that stigma come down a bit? Because some of the parts that I read, it still seemed like that's how things are today still.
I actually was thinking about doing a new edition, and I was reading through it to see what would need to be changed, and there wasn't much. and that's sad. I think it is more a part of the conversation. People are more aware of it. More people talk about it. There are more articles about it. It appears on TV shows and all that's, you know, when it appears accurately on TV shows, those are all kind of good things. And yet I'll still sit next to somebody on a plane and, you know, what do you do? Start talking and he'll go, oh, you know, they said my teenager was depressed, but she just needed a firmer hand, you know, and stuff like that. And it's just like, I can't believe this is still the way people feel about it. And yet, I guess if they didn't, I'd be out of work. So I always say you have to sort of look back and see how far you've come so that you know you've accomplished something. And you have to look forward and see how far you have to go so that you know you need to still keep going.
Why does the stigma still exist? Does part of it have to do with people who are struggling with depression? Maybe they're having a hard time talking about it, or it's just one of those things that people don't want to talk about?
I think there are, and this is kind of off the top of my head, really, several different reasons probably. One is just that it's really pretty new that we're able to talk about it at all. And I think it takes a long time for a cultural change of thinking about something. It just wasn't that long ago that, you know, it was blamed on the moon or something. You know, it just really has come along pretty recently that we understand the brain at all. And certainly in the last 20 years, the understanding of the brain is huge. And the change in medications and everything else has been substantial. And I think people are still frightened or baffled. And, of course, fear leads to all kinds of other ways of thinking about things, about anything that has to do with the brain. Well, look at the way things are with dementia and Alzheimer's and how stigmatized that is and how terrified people are of that and of how many misunderstandings there are about that. It's sort of the next cultural brain frontier of saying, well, this is a real illness and it's nobody's fault. And we have to adapt to them, not expect them to adapt to us because they have no control over it, and kind of be grown-ups about it.
And you're here in La Crosse. You're going to be talking about erasing the stigma of mental illness. So what advice do you have for people with depression or maybe others who have relationships with people with depression?
The absolute first foremost thing is to understand that it's a medical illness and that people don't have total control over it. There's a lot of help in cognitive behavioral therapy, which does, you know, have to do with being more conscious about your thoughts and having more control over them. But it's not the same as, you know, expecting someone to snap out of it. And so the first thing is to realize it is a real illness. It's not in someone's control. It's not something they're doing to you, even though it might feel like it. If somebody is emotionally out of control, it doesn't feel good to have that directed at you. You're the one standing there. It's going to be directed at you or directed against themselves, of course. You have to constantly remind yourself this is the illness talking. This isn't them. This is the illness talking. And to be able to provide the support for them, too, that they need of saying this is the illness talking. It's going to get better. It's an illness. It's going to get better. We'll find a solution. If this doesn't work, we'll find something else.
Have the doctors and the experts been able to figure out what brings it on, and can they narrow it down to a medical cause, an emotional cause, or anything like that?
Actually, it's interesting because similar to other medical illnesses, and I think of high blood pressure and some cancers and some heart problems, there actually is a sort of a nexus of genetics and environmental factors and personal factors and stress-related factors that can come together and create the expression of the illness. I sometimes think of it as a chain with a weak link, and then it might be that you have just the kind of temperature and pressure conditions that break that link, and the illness expresses itself, or you might not, and that it's a combination of factors. But
and in your experience, how far back does it go?
One of the things they're thinking about is that, and particularly University of Michigan Depression Center conference, I was talking to some people up there about it, that perhaps whenever you see depression, it probably started in childhood but wasn't recognized or came on very slowly from then. And when I, as a consequence of that phone call, went back, because I would have said teenage. It started when I was a teenager. But I started looking back at my school records when my parents moved from their house to their apartment, and I went and picked up all my leftover junk, my report cards back to elementary school, and there were clues in there saying, you know, forgetfulness, not paying attention, sometimes charming and sometimes sullen, different kinds of clues that there may have been some early signs. I would not have said I was a depressed child, but there may have been some clues there.
Now you have, of course, written a book about other children of famous people. People may assume that having a well-known parent might have put some stress into your childhood and your upbringing. Has that been determined? Do you think that was a contributing factor to what you had over the years?
I don't know. I think, yes, as you said, it may have added some stress, but not so much that it would make a difference. And I think I've seen many therapists over the years, and up until the time I was diagnosed, I was kind of bouncing around from one to another trying to get someone who could help me. And I remember one of them being determined to discuss my father's fame as a reason for me not feeling well. And after two or three sessions, I said, you know, I have dealt with all this in the first five therapists I saw. I really don't think I need to keep dealing with it. There must be something else. And I think it's an obvious go-to answer because it's the most unique thing about my early life that people can identify. Therefore, there must be a connection. And I don't think there probably is as much of a connection as people would think. It wasn't that stressful, for one thing. It was the times it was most stressful were the times when I also was having other problems.
Yeah, I would think it would be a great source of pride for you, or at least a status symbol in your life. It's like, my dad's Walter Cronkite, and he got to do the space missions and things like that.
Neither nor. Yes, I was very proud of him. Always was, always will be, without a doubt. I never have been very comfortable, and it's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I never have been very comfortable being out about that. My father's Walter Cronkite, and he got to, you know, never been very comfortable with that, no.
I'm wondering, when you wrote your book and when you talk with other people who have depression, does it seem like a weight is coming off their chest once they do open up about it? And do you suggest that other people maybe, I don't know, necessarily write a book like you did, but do talk with people about it?
I think it's very healing. I think it always feels better to know you're not alone. And there are some wonderful organizations, NAMI and DBSA, and those are the two that come to mind, Recovery, that have group support for each other that I think can be very, very important. I think it was when I set out to write the book, and I wrote a proposal, and you write a proposal in a first chapter, basically. And so for my first interview, for my sort of trial interview, I went to interview Mike Wallace. His was a trigger for me, and also I knew him, so it was comfortable. And when you get to the end of the interview, I don't know whether you all do this, but most interviewers do, say, well, is there anything else you want to say that I didn't ask you about, whatever? And he just looked me in the eye, and he said, it takes one to know one. And it's still, I think about it, and it still means a lot to me that there was that connection of we're all in this together.
And you're listening to Newsmakers. My guest today is Kathy Cronkite. She's a writer and journalist, and she's here in La Crosse this week talking about erasing the stigma of mental illness. Some people suffer from depression because it's biological. Others, there may be something situational that's triggered it in their life. Can you talk about the difference between maybe what depression is, those who are struggling with depression, and also maybe someone who's just dealing with a bout of sadness?
There's a difference between sort of everyday blues and depression and grief. And the symptoms of grief and depression can be very similar. One of the main differences with grief is that there does tend to be more of an overwhelming sadness and loss about it. You also might not be sleeping well, might not be eating well, might be more irritable, some of those other things. The isolation is a big part of depression, and usually that's one of the differences, is that with depression you're more likely to go in your room and shut your door. With grief, you're a little more likely to want to be with other people, to share the grief or to comfort you or whatever. One of the biggest differences is that with grief, it will gradually get better and better and better over a period of days, weeks, months, whatever. And with depression, it doesn't. In fact, it often spirals down worse before it gets better. The key distinction that's important is that if it is interfering with your normal life, if you find you can't fix dinner and you're just eating out of cans all the time, or if you can't get your kids to school on time, or if you can't function at the office, or you don't want to go do the things that you usually do, usually have a walking group by the river and you don't go anymore, and start withdrawing from activities or not being able to do regular things. That's sort of the key thing, is does it affect your quality of life and your ability to function? And if it does, then you might think of it more as an illness and need to get help. I mean, you need to get help anyway if you can't function or you aren't having friends. And the symptoms of the illness work against you getting help for yourself, because one of the symptoms of the illness is shame and guilt. And so you say, oh, you know, it's all my fault. I should be able to take care of myself. I should be able to get to work. Once you get into all those shoulds, you know you're in trouble, right? I should do this. I should do that. The sort of apathy of the illness makes you say, oh, what difference does it make whether I go to work or not? And the cognitive confusion of the illness makes you say, well, I wouldn't know how to get help anyway. And it's just everything in it works against you getting help for yourself. And that's why it's so important to have people around you and to be taking care of each other, where you can say, you know, what I see is, you're not eating, you're not sleeping, you're not going to work, and I'm worried about you, and let's go see someone together.
And our next question comes from Wisdom Radio's Brad Williams.
I would like to follow up on that point you just mentioned, as far as the friends and relatives trying to deal with it, and they know that there's a problem and may not know as much about what you're going through or even how to approach it, because it's difficult for them as well. Are there standard sort of behavior or ways that somebody can deal with a person who has depression?
On a one-to-one relationship basis, the most important thing is to remember that it's an illness and that not to take it personally. If they're upset or angry or withdrawing or weeping or whatever, that isn't really about you. It's because they have an illness, any more than, I don't know, but it's not about you. And that getting somebody to help can be the most important thing you can do. I recommend that if you have a friend that needs help, that you find out first where you're going to take them. Because sadly, even among professionals, not everybody is very educated about depression. And there are still people who will pat you on the hand and say, there, there, dear, just get a good night's sleep. And while faith can be an incredibly important piece of the recovery process for people, There are religious leaders who are very well informed and helpful, and there are those who aren't and who will say, well, you know, you need to pray harder, or it's a dark night of the soul, dear, or whatever. So I strongly recommend that if you think somebody needs help, you call their family doctor or whoever it is you would take them to first and say, this is what's going on, what do you think, and kind of feel them out. And then there were a couple of people in my book that said their lives were saved by friends making the appointment, coming to their front door saying, we are going to the doctor now, get in the car, and taking them to the doctor physically. That's not always necessary, but there is an isolation that happens where you sort of withdraw into yourself in your room and feel hopeless and don't feel that there's anything that could help anyway, and all those other things that we said before. So it could get to that.
What kind of developments have been found in the last few years by the researchers of new ways of therapy and treating this that may not have been available before?
You know, there are always new medications and new combinations of old medications that people find helpful. It can be a challenge finding exactly the right one because we are each unique biological creatures with, you know, unique chemistry. It's, you know, it's a very, particularly when you're dealing with brain medications and structures, it's a very tricky balancing to get the effect you want without getting side effects you don't want. And they're getting better and better. The next big breakthrough is going to be, which is very close, when they can determine genetically which medication is going to be the most effective for you. And that's going to be a real new dawn kind of thing in the treatment of any kind of psychiatric illness. But meanwhile, they're refining and refining and refining and being able to tinker and fine-tune with, again, with combinations with different things. It can be a trial and error kind of thing, but as one of my great mentors, John Rush in Dallas, says, you know, if you're not trying, that's the error.
Kathy Cronkite is an author and journalist. She travels the country speaking about the need to erase the stigma that surrounds mental health. Cronkite spoke today at the annual luncheon to benefit the Women's Fund of Greater La Crosse. I'd also like to thank Brad Williams of Wisdom Radio in La Crosse for helping to ask questions. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes Steve Roysom, Mary Meehan Stroob, John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. To hear this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. In addition to Newsmakers, you'll find archived reports and special series produced by the La Crosse News Bureau, as well as network news from Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR. And if you'd like to comment on this week's Newsmakers or have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/lacrosse.